Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to Policy Forum Pod, the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. I'm Martin Pierce. This podcast is brought to you by Policy Forum at Crawford School of Public Policy at the Australian National University. Crawford School is the region's leading graduate policy school. If you want to find out how to take your public policy career to the next level, come and join us for your postgraduate degree or short courses. You can learn more about what options are available and how to apply at crawford.anu.edu.au/study. And I am delighted to welcome back into the studio. It's been an awful long time since we've had her in here. My co-host today, Sue Regan. Hello, Sue.
Hello, Martin.
It's great to have you here. Sue is a PhD scholar at Crawford School. And it's, as I said, it's been a while since we've had you in the studio. Just how much did you miss us?
I missed you lots, Martin, and the pod team. I just felt like I needed to stop juggling so many balls so that I could finish my PhD. And I've submitted my thesis now. So
congratulations.
Thank you, Martin. I can relax and it's good to be back.
Were you pleased with how the thesis came out?
Yes, not bad. I think it's a great achievement. I could have kept working on it, but I was pretty pleased, happy enough that I could submit.
Well, it is a huge achievement to submit a thesis, so well done.
Thank you.
Now, what's caught your eye in the world of policy over the last week?
Well, a couple of things have caught my eye this week. The Prime Minister has announced a $3.8 billion infrastructure stimulus, and this has followed calls from the Reserve Bank that we need a fiscal stimulus given how low interest rates are at the moment. And I think it'll be interesting to see the details of what the stimulus is going to be in the coming weeks. So that's one really for us all to keep our eyes on. But the other policy issue that's caught my eye was the government's announcement on robo-debt. The robo-debt program, I think we've talked about on the podcast a while ago, operates by sending automatically generated notices to welfare recipients. And, and these state that recipients have to clarify their income or they have to repay a debt.
It's caused a lot of stress for a lot of people.
I think there's a huge amount of evidence now that it's caused high levels of hardship and stress and trauma, even with people receiving these notices out of the blue. So in a way, this is a bit of a concession by the government that they've decided that they will no longer raise a debt where the only evidence they have is from the Australian Taxation Office, this average incoming method of calculating debt. And they've also said, that they would review all current debts that are outstanding. So this is good news. I think it will help reduce further hardship. We don't yet know what the extent of the changes will be. But I thought it was also interesting because it tells us something about perhaps the limits of automation, in particular automation in systems which are about humans and their very complex lives. So that caught my eye. What about you, Martin? What's caught your eye in the world of policy this week?
Can I say I have barely noticed anything in the world of policy over the last week because I have been working on something. In fact, the whole Policy Forum team has been working on something quite special. It's a big week for us and for the podcast because yesterday we celebrated 5 years of Policy Forum, the website. From humble beginnings, the site's gone on to publish nearly 2,000 pieces in that time from more than 1,400 contributors from all around the world. It's been An amazing journey, actually, and thanks to everyone who has been involved with that throughout that 5 years. And to celebrate our fifth anniversary, the Policy Forum team have been working really hard to bring an all-new, more modern and user-friendly design of the Policy Forum website, which went live yesterday. Do check it out if you haven't seen it or you visited it for a while. I think it looks lovely. And for Roberto, we also invited authors that have previously written for Policy Forum to contribute new pieces for our special In Focus section, which we're calling Policy Futures. And in that section, we are shedding light on what lies ahead for some key areas of policy in the coming 5 years and what policymakers should be focusing on. So listeners, don't forget to check it out after you're finished listening to this part.
That sounds great, Martin. Now, today on the podcast, we want to look at innovation and the wealth gap in Australia. Amazing new technologies such as artificial intelligence and genetical advances have brought huge benefits to society. However, in Australia, income and wealth inequality have increased in recent times, and our record on innovation is poor. So today we want to ask, how can we encourage innovation and help create a more equal society? We have a very special guest to take on this question, haven't we, Martin?
We certainly do. It's someone that we've been trying to organise to get on the podcast for a while, so I'm really excited that we've actually been able to get him on for this episode. It is Andrew Lee, MP. Andrew is the Shadow Assistant Minister for Treasury. He's the Shadow Assistant Minister for Charities, and he's also the Federal Member for FENA here in the ACT. Now, he's the author of a new book with Joshua Gans, which is called Innovation Plus Equality, How to Create a Future That is More Star Trek Than Terminator. So that appeals to the sci-fi nerd in me, as well as the fact that I'm interested in economics. He's also the host of the excellent The Good Life podcast. Give that a listen if you haven't checked it out. And he's formerly of This Manor. He used to be an ANU professor. So we're really excited to talk to Andrew. So how about we hear what he has to say? Welcome, Andrew. Great to have you on the podcast.
Thanks, Martin. Thanks, Sue. Great to be with you.
Andrew, in your new book with Joshua Gans, it's called Innovation and Equality. You write that if we encourage innovation in the right way, our future can look more like the cheerful techno-utopia of Star Trek than the dark techno-dystopia of the Terminator. So first of all, let me test your nerd credentials here. Which Star Trek are we referring to? Is it James T. Kirk, Jean-Luc Picard, or one of the sort of later, darker Netflix style?
Well, I think we're thinking of the original Star Trek, the one that Joshua Gans and I grew up on, and it's using a metaphor first put forward by Jerry Kaplan, the technology writer, who suggested that there's these two visions of the future, one in which the machines take over, as in Terminator, another in which we're able to harness technology to live a better life, as in Star Trek. We think that we ought to be optimistic about the future so long as we get the policy settings right. We can have more innovation and more equality.
And to continue on a pop culture theme, just for one more question. I mean, there are plenty of concerns around our technological future, particularly around AI. Do you worry in any way that we might be currently on a path towards a sort of Terminator T-1000 style future?
Joshua and I don't stay awake at night worrying about the singularity, but it's there as a possibility, and certainly organisations that look at existential risks factor that in, along with pandemics and nuclear holocaust, as one of the things that could ultimately imperil society. But our book isn't so much about the singularity. We use it more as a metaphor. When you think about a society in which robots can do better than all of us, it helps someone with tertiary degrees put themselves in the shoes of a routine worker who's seen themselves squeezed out by factory robots or by accounting software, which has caused manufacturing work or the work of bookkeepers to decline.
So, Andrew, I'm just wondering, what was the motivation for this book? What motivated you to write it?
I've always been passionate about inequality. Joshua Gans has always been passionate about innovation. And we talked over the years about the interplay between the two, including when I was a professor here at the Australian National University. It took a while for the book to get going. But once it did, we found lots of ways in which we could construct policies that would hit in the sweet spot of innovation and equality. Economists are fond of quoting Arthur Oaken's equity efficiency trade-off, the idea that you can have fairness or you can have growth, but you can't have both. It turns out in a whole host of areas, from getting intellectual property right to getting copyright law right to investing in great schooling systems for disadvantaged children, policies that boost equality often boost innovation too.
So let's talk a little more about innovation, and particularly innovation in Australia. Across the sample of around 30 OECD nations, Australia ranked fourth last for the share of large businesses collaborating on innovation, and sixth last in businesses collaborating with suppliers, and second last in collaboration between businesses and universities. That doesn't all sound good. Why is Australia lagging behind other developed nations in this space?
Martin, it's partly a cultural issue. A survey which asked Australians whether they'd be deterred from starting a business by fear of failure find 41% say yes, which is higher than the number that you get in the United Kingdom or the United States. But that's only part of the answer. I think it's also the institutions. As you say, we've got very little collaboration on innovation between our research institutions and businesses. To just give you a stark example of that, if you walk the streets around Stanford or MIT, you'll stumble across a whole lot of spin-off businesses. If you walk the streets around a Go8 university in Australia, you'll most likely stumble across a bunch of terrific restaurants and cafes. So we need to do more to encourage business to work better with the universities sector. We also, in our view, need to make sure that there are greater opportunities for children from disadvantaged backgrounds to connect with mentors to become entrepreneurs. Only a quarter of entrepreneurs are women. Only a small share come from these disadvantaged backgrounds, largely because the Bank of Mum and Dad funds a lot of startups. So the more we can do to identify the lost Marie Curies and the lost Albert Einsteins, the more innovative and more equal society will be.
Can I just ask you a bit more about that fear of failure thing? Why, I mean, you've talked about some of the ways that Australia should be addressing this, but do you think what are the kind of cultural reasons that would suggest that, you know, Australians have a greater fear of failure than perhaps, you know, Americans?
We've got a solid social safety net, so that shouldn't explain the difference between us and other countries. But it may also be the unwillingness of Australian managers to see failure as being a tray they should select on. If you've got an economy where most industries are oligopolies, then their focus is not in chasing down new markets and coming up with fresh ideas. It's about building a bigger moat and protecting what they've got. And that leads to a great degree of caution among your biggest companies. So if we had more competition in other sectors of the Australian economy, that would breed a more entrepreneurial mindset among managers, which would then have positive spin-offs for a whole lot of small businesses as well.
What do you think are the other challenges that people face when they want to become innovators? I'm thinking about, you know, the diversity we have in our society, and, you know, what are the challenges that particular people might face, say women or people with disability?
It's often about not seeing startup entrepreneurs who are like you. So one of my favourite examples is Resolution 123. It's a company which works on online employment law, started by a woman who saw it as an opportunity when she was returning from maternity leave. But not every startup is like that. Young men from advantaged backgrounds are disproportionately represented among our startup entrepreneurs. Joshua Gans at the Creative Destruction Lab at the University of Toronto focuses on what he calls the missing market for judgment, the idea that often as a startup entrepreneur, even if you've got the money and the idea, you often don't know the uses to which it can be put and how you'll fit within that bigger business ecosystem. That's where mentors can come in, and that's where a great mentoring program, ideally with mentors who look like the entrepreneurs, can really make a difference.
are things changing? I mean, we are seeing, you're talking about sort of mentorship programs and things like that. And I feel like over the last few years, we have seen a sort of push towards that. Are things changing in Australia towards the kind of future that you're talking about? Or are we stuck?
They're changing on the input side, but not on the output side. So in terms of inputs, we have a whole lot of startup incubator programs at Australian universities, which are increasingly thinking not only how do they churn out a dozen entrepreneurs a year, but how do they give a large share of their undergraduate cohort a startup experience. But if you look at the aggregate statistics, things are changing, Martin, and not in a good way. 8% of Australian businesses say they produce an innovation that's new to the world, but that's down from 11% in 2013. We've seen a fall in the number of new businesses being created in Australia, and a decline in the job switching rate, suggesting that the Australian economy is less dynamic today than it was in the past.
And you've already talked about how in Australia there is a greater fear of failure. Now, how can we encourage more people to innovate in Australia given those high levels of failure fear?
It's about making innovation less scary and about making it less of an elite sport. I think of the best innovation programs as being democratizing innovation, encouraging people to think about being innovators if they're studying physiotherapy as well as if they're studying engineering, recognising that breakthroughs can come in all sorts of interesting ways. They can be process breakthroughs as well as product breakthroughs. But to think of ourselves as a nation that makes things that are new to the world will not only make us more prosperous, but also will provide a greater sense of agility. The thing we can be sure about in the labour market over the next couple of generations is that it will change markedly. The thing we can't be sure about is precisely how it will change. Joshua Gans and I are very sceptical of people who think they've got a perfect crystal ball, that they can forecast precisely which jobs will grow and which will shrink. And we talk about some of the methodological problems in studies that claim to have done this. Instead, we need to accept that uncertainty is just a fundamental fact.
Mm. Given that, though, I mean, I think we can agree that uncertainty is a fact that we have to deal with. It's we still would want more innovations to be successful. How would we go about that?
Ensuring that there's appropriate venture capital pool as part of it, but also that those venture capital entrepreneurs or venture capital investors can have access to entrepreneurs. And when you see this in action, it's terrific fun. I went along to a pitch night at the Canberra Innovation Network in the city a couple of weeks ago. It came off the back of a fortnight in Parliament, which had been particularly dispiriting. You'd expect me to say that. I'm in the opposition. But to be there on the pitch night and see these fresh new ideas being put forward by Australian entrepreneurs to venture capitalists, that was great fun. And we need to see more of that, more of those new ideas emerging. And the more that our Australian economy allows spaces for new ideas to flourish, the better. The risk of monopolies is that they can, like a large oak tree in the forest, overshadow the saplings and make it difficult for new ideas and businesses to emerge.
What's the role of government in all of this? I mean, you've talked about, you know, how corporations need to change their mindset to encourage innovation and allay people's fear of failures. But what can government do to get in and encourage this?
Part of it is in the direct innovation. Mariana Mazzucato at the University College London has pointed out that many of the innovations that we use today are the process of government research. And she gives examples. If you just pick up your smartphone, you look at a whole lot of technologies underpinning it, from the GPS to the internet to touchscreens, emerge from government research. One study that looked at 200-odd drugs that had emerged in the United States aimed to find what share of those 200 had received government funding in their development, and the answer was all of them. So there's a big role for government in that, particularly in that basic stage innovation. There's also an importance in making sure that the institutions are fostering moonshot innovation, encouraging people.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
People to go big rather than just go incremental. Joshua and I also think there's scope for innovation prizes rather than only funding people to try, occasionally you should fund people to succeed. What that can do is it can lead to the development of unconventional teams, people who wouldn't necessarily have the CVs to attract the research funding, but who have the smarts and the out-of-the-box idea to get there better than anyone else.
Now, your book isn't just about innovation, it's about innovation and equality. So explain to us the link between innovation and inequality, and particularly that link in a sort of Australian context.
People often argue that inequality is just the price of progress, that the fact that the earnings have risen three times as fast for the top tenth of Australian workers as the bottom tenth of Australian workers is simply the price of progress. The fact that since the beginning of the 21st century, wealth has stayed flat for the bottom fifth, but gone up by more than $1 million for the top fifth. Well, that's just what you've got to have in order to have an innovation, technologically driven society. We reject that. We don't think that most innovation is about the size of the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, but instead it's about the impediments to going searching in the first place. So we believe that there's a lot more scope for making sure that we have great teachers in disadvantaged schools. We think having trades training, which is generalist and plugged into the rise of online training, is absolutely vital. And writing for a US audience, because we're publishing with MIT Press, we urge America to move away from its current student loan system towards something that looks more like the Australian HEX help system.
But in the Australian context, how can we become both more entrepreneurial and more equal at the same time?
It's partly about getting education right. It's partly about getting the competitive ecosystem right. It's also in part about making sure that our intellectual property laws are fit for purpose. Intellectual property provides a temporary monopoly, which can make inequality worse. We need to make sure that we're getting the trade-off right there, and so ideas are placed readily out into the public domain. We also think that there's more that you could do with startup entrepreneurs in schools, where the whole innovation mantra just isn't reaching right now. So why not think about programs in disadvantaged communities, which aim to identify those who have a new idea and want to make a difference. I can't believe that 22% of all the great ideas in Australia are being developed by women, who constitute 51% of the population. So we ought to do more to encourage talented women to be able to follow that entrepreneurship route.
Andrew, you make it sound easy. I just wonder if you could talk to us more about the challenges in this, being both entrepreneurial and more equal. It's not happening. So it feels like there's, very big, perhaps cultural or economic challenges here.
Vested interests don't like being challenged, and if you're a firm which currently has non-compete clauses, you quite enjoy the fact that you're telling your workers that they cannot switch to a competitor and cannot start a competing business. A fifth of American workers have these clauses in their employment contracts. The big incumbents like them, but they're doing damage to the nimble startups who could otherwise be creating a whole lot more prosperity for the US economy, and it does damage to workers. Anytime you make it harder for workers to shift jobs, you put downward pressure on wages and you increase wage inequality.
Andrew, we've talked about what governments should be doing. We've talked about what corporations could and should be doing. But, there would be a lot of people listening to this podcast that might think that they've got an innovative idea or they would like to develop an innovative idea, what should individuals be doing to tackle some of the problems that you've identified here?
If you've got an innovative idea, go for it and recognise that the right sort of employer will see a failure as an innovator as a strength for your next job. But even if you're working in a corporation or in government, recognise that you've got a role in changing the systems that encourage more ideas to come forward. One of the other important things that Joshua and I point to is the gender gap. Half the population are women, 51% in fact. And one of the factors that is exacerbating the gender gap is sexual harassment. Sexual harassment doesn't just impede growth, it also impedes fairness. And people who speak out in the face of off-colour jokes, harassing behaviour, workplace norms that aren't consistent with where we ought to be in 2019, improve the quality of their workplace. So if you're speaking out against sexual harassment, you're going to help make Australia more innovative and more equal. And that's a great thing.
As we're based at one of Australia's main research and education hubs, the Australian National University, I'd also like to know what role can universities play specifically in driving innovation and fostering equality?
Universities shouldn't be too jealous in taking the intellectual property of their professors. Some of the experiments that have been done have shown that when universities take an excessively large share of the intellectual property, you see less innovation as a result. Universities also have a great role to play in matching mentors with innovators. And there's a whole host of these programs going on around the country that I know ANU is implementing but also learning from. I love the fact that the University of Wollongong, for example, in its iAccelerate program is taking advantage of the fact that it's in a city with a surplus of skilled manufacturing workers. And ANU being in a city where there's significant government innovation and defence innovation also has great potential for extending the engagement between ANU students who want to start something and established businesses who want to mentor a bright student.
So just finally, talking about the sort of way forward here, Andrew, what is the one thing that the Australian government could do right now that would best encourage innovation that could help create a more equal society?
Make teacher quality the central focus of education policy. We talk a lot in education policy about the curriculum, about class sizes, about ways in which we do testing. But all of that falls by the wayside if you can get highly talented people into the classroom and keep them there. And yet a succession of studies, my own work with Chris Ryan while I was at the ANU, but also work recently by the Grattan Institute, has shown that the academic aptitude of new teachers is falling rather than rising. We need to make teacher quality a core national priority if we are to boost productivity and improve equality. We should ensure that teachers no longer train on poor kids and finish their careers teaching rich kids, but instead that disadvantaged schools have terrific teachers at the front of the classroom. If we can get that teacher effectiveness piece right, as Finland did as recently as the 1970s, we can have the same sort of turnaround that Finland had, moving on the international league tables from a position behind Australia to one where it's now streets ahead of us.
One last question before we let you go, Andrew. In our Facebook podcast group, we maintain a list of great podcasts that people are listening to.
I think your own podcast is actually on that list, Andrew.
Good, good. Very exciting. Thank you.
But what else is currently on your playlist?
I really enjoy Conversations with Tyler, Tyler Cowen's podcast, because it doesn't pretend to be for anyone else. It's pitched as the conversation that Tyler wants to have. It is ad hoc and jumpy. There's no pretense at segues from topic to topic, but that willingness to read deeply on one person's work and then dive into the open questions, the inconsistencies, and how they relate to the world's big topics. I relish that as I run through the Canberra bush of a morning.
Great. We'll make sure that's on the list.
It certainly gets added to the list.
Yeah. Andrew, thank you very much for coming in today. That was a fascinating conversation, and it sounds like your new book is going to be a very good read. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Sue. Thanks, Martin.
Welcome back, and thanks once again, Andrew, for that really interesting discussion. Listeners, we are really keen to get your thoughts on what we've talked about today. You can reach out to us. We're on Facebook. You can find us as Policy Forum Pod on there. Or you can also contact us on Twitter, where we are Apps Policy Forum, APPS Policy Forum. Or you can go old school and send us an email, podcast@policyforum.net. And also, if you've ever thought about getting into a policy-facing role, then perhaps the Master of Economic Policy at Crawford School might be for you. In this program, you will learn more about public finance, foreign investment, trade and development economics, and work with experts to understand more about government intervention and policy instruments to achieve equity. You can find all the information and how to apply at crawford.anu.edu.au/study. Now, let's have a look at some of your questions and comments. I always enjoy this bit. So there was an article that we put up on Policy Forum last week called "Is New Start Slowly Killing People?" It was by Elise Klein. And in the piece, Elise writes that it's well established that New Start and its related payments are inadequate for the people relying on them, and that the social security system that Australia originally set up to curb poverty is now only making it worse, and it's causing negative health outcomes for struggling Australians. And we had a comment from Carl Viet on Facebook, who wrote, "New Start was never intended for people to rely on. It was supposed to help people for several weeks looking for jobs." What do you make of that, Sue?
Well, it's certainly the case that the welfare system has evolved, economic conditions have changed, and some people are staying on New Start for considerable lengths of time. I think the main point in Elise's article is that, the evidence is overwhelming now that the rate is too low of New Start, and that it's really not very helpful to put people into abject poverty when they're trying to find work. So there is this, I'm part of this broad consensus now, which is, in the community sector, but also in the business sector, which is that we really do need an increase in the New Start rate.
And yet we're not seeing much movement on that dial, are we?
No, we're not. I feel in a way that particularly the current government has backed itself into a political corner on this one. And of course, it costs money to increase the rate of New Start, and the continued desire for a surplus means that, new spending commitments are very difficult. So yes, it's still, despite that broad consensus, it still unfortunately feels like we may be some way off from getting an increase in the rate.
So thanks for that comment, Carl. The next I want to have a look at is a comment on the podcast that we put out last week, and it was called Beyond Declaring a Climate Emergency, and it was Shane Rattenbury, Imrad Ahmed and Liz Hanna. And in that podcast, our great green debate team returned to discuss the remaining audience submitted questions of our recent live event. And the panel took a look at why it's high time to speak about climate change in the context of Australia's dramatic bushfires, how we can ensure a just energy transition, and what peaceful protests can really do to spur climate action. And we had a comment from Vanessa on our Facebook group, Policy Forum Pod. Once again, do jump in and join us there. And Vanessa wrote, "Thank you for the timely podcast. You're welcome, Vanessa. Just picking up on the comments about politicians not accepting the science of climate change. Will removing political donations from those profiting off fossil fuels assist in changing the mindset of a number of politicians? I'm finding it very difficult to understand why there is such a blatant disregard for what the experts are saying. What do you think about that, Sue?
So yes, there's no doubt that vested interests are influencing the climate change debate, and political donations are part of that murky world of exercising your vested interests. I think Vanessa's concern is also part of a wider and perhaps more dangerous trend in disregarding expertise and experts more generally, and it's something that many scholars and policy experts and others are fighting and trying to increase the voice of experts in policy reform.
Of course, there was that famous quote from Michael Gove from a few years back where he was talking about how Britain had had enough of experts. Was that the beginning of where the kind of rot set in, or had it already started at that point?
Yeah, I think it was already rotting at that stage. I think he, in a way, articulated a sense in the, in the political classes in particular that expertise hadn't been helpful at times. So it's I think where we are today with a distrust of expertise in some areas has a long legacy, and I think will take some time to address as well.
Do you think that disregard of expertise is from politicians towards experts, or does it also come from society?
I think it probably is both. I think there's such a multitude of information and data out there now that it's very difficult for people to know what is good information, what is the truth, if that exists. So I think it is a wider societal concern, and very difficult to know, which experts to believe, because of course, there's a lot of contested issues out there, and not all experts agree on what is the evidence.
That's a great comment, Vanessa. Many thanks for that. And we really appreciate everyone who has got in contact with us over the last week to leave us a comment or leave us a question. If you would like to do the same, the best way to do that is to reach out to us on Facebook, where we are Policy Forum Pod. Join the group there. Or you can hit us up on Twitter, where we're Apps Policy Forum, or email us at podcast@policyforum.net. Now, staying on the topic of the Facebook group, I would like to say a big hello to a few of our new members of the group there. So hello to Renee Manning, Craig Davis, Megan Fitzharris. That's Megan Fitzharris, who was on Democracy Sausage on Monday. Did you listen to that, Sue? It was terrific.
I did, yeah. It was great. Really interesting.
Great stuff. And to Rayleigh O'Neill as well. Hello to all of you. It's great to have you on board. And special thanks to Craig, who gave us an idea for a future episode of Policy Forum Pod, which I want to run past you, Sue. Craig suggested he would like to find out more about lobbying in a real way, not just conspiracy stuff, but actually join in the dots about how policies are formed on both sides that don't seem to serve the public on either left or right. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. I mean, in particular, his idea about looking at lobbying. I think it's one of those kind of dark arts that we, don't know enough about. So, yeah, that's a great idea.
Yeah, so thanks for submitting that topic, Craig. We're actually keeping a list of all of the suggestions we get for potential future pods on a whiteboard in the office, so we'll be sure to add that. And if you listeners would also like to get your ideas up on the whiteboard, you might want to reach out to us on that Facebook podcast group. Type in Policy Forum Pod and you will find us there. That's Lydio, Branko, Julia and me. We're all there. And you can also reach us on Twitter, of course, where we're Apps Policy Forum, or email us podcast@policyforum.net. And if you liked today's episode, don't forget to subscribe to this podcast. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts from. Now, today's episode has been written by Julia Ahrens. It's been edited by Branko Svedijevic, with executive production by me, Martin Pierce. We'll be back with another episode of Policy Forum Pod next week. But until then, from me, cheerio.
And from me, Sue, cheerio too.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.